I have a message from another time. Avery Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 2. Fourth Movement, Knights of the Tenth World, Part 1, Opening Maneuvers, by Benjamin D. Hutchins, which is me, and Philip J. Moyer. Sunday, March 5th, 2406. Asgard. The inner chamber of the Council of the Aesir, ruling body of the high celestial worlds of Asgard, Vanaheim, and Alfheim, is a place few residents of these worlds, to say nothing of the other six, ever see. Most public council business is conducted in the Great Hall of the Palace of Odin Winterbeard, chairman of the council, leader of the gods, ruler of Asgard, etc., etc. If a minor god or common citizen of the realms has ever seen the full council assembled, it is there, in that vast and vaulted hall, that the meeting has taken place. The inner chamber is a much smaller, more intimate room, large enough for the nine gods of the council, and a few invited, or, given that this is the Aesir council we're talking about, perhaps summoned is more appropriate, guests, and little else. There is no observation gallery, no balcony seating, not even enough room for Thor to dance a decent Kazakh shock without getting up on the table to do it, and Odin frowns upon that. It's a very old table, and he doesn't like it getting scuffed. Corwin Ravenhair had been in this room once before, and not for any official purpose. He had been 4 years old, and had wandered from his grandfather's office through the mysterious leather-padded door behind the old man's desk, curious as to where it led. He'd found himself here, in this intimate but opulent chamber, with its great oblong table, edges polished bright by centuries on centuries of being rubbed by the elbows of the greatest of gods, its walls full of the tomes of ages, and its holographic briefing tank. When his mother tracked him down, he had that tank about half apart. It took the two of them the rest of the afternoon to repair it, after which he'd been admonished that this was a special room into which he should refrain from barging in the future. As such, never having been summoned to it, he'd never returned until now. And it struck him as he stood at attention in his Valkyrie dress uniform, with Nall, sleek and gleaming in his gold and white draconic finery on his shoulder, that it seemed a great deal smaller now than then. Part of that was because it was crowded, of course, with all the Aesir Council in their seats, and another besides. Also, any room tended to seem smaller with Thor Ironhammer in it. Then, of course, there was the fact that Corwin was here for the most important meeting of his life. Odin entered from the far end, through the door from his office, and quieted the soft chatter of the other gods with his entrance as he strode to the head of the table, opposite Corwin. "This is an official proceeding of the Council of the Aesir," he intoned in his business voice. "Council Chairman and ruler of the gods, Odin Winterbeard, presiding. Those counselors in attendance will speak their names for the record." To Odin's left, a graying, heavily bearded, muscular man with only one hand, his other arm ended in a brass cap, rose to his feet. "Tyrgrimjaws, god of war, present." Opposite him, big, red-headed, barn-sized Thor stood up and declared, "Thor Ironhammer, god of thunder, present." Beside Thor sat a tall, blond, very handsome man who rose and said, "Frey Lightwalker, god of security, present." Seated opposite Frey was a woman who looked very much like him. The reason for this was apparent as she stood. "Freya Lightwalker, goddess of medicine, present." The man next to Freya was very similar in appearance to her and her twin brother, and only a little older looking. Calmly, with a faint smile, he rose and said, "Niord Seafarer, god of the sea, present." Across from Njord was a burly, weather-beaten, and craggy man with bright blue eyes and the sky-blue uniform of the Air Force. "Heimdall Farseeker, God of Vigilance, present." The woman next to Njord was distinctive in this room of pale Nordic types. Her skin was the color of brown sugar, her hair pure white, and her eyes a startling green. She got to her feet with a panther's grace, smiling lazily, and said, "Urter Snowman, goddess of love, present." The last person at the table was another tall blonde woman, younger than Freya, and taller, dressed like Corwin in the black and silver of the Valkyria. She rose and said, "Brunhilde Silverspear, Valkyrie Deputy Commander, present for Skuld Ravenhair, goddess of technology." Odin nodded, satisfied. "All counselors are present or accounted for," he noted. "This proceeding may begin. Be seated." They sat, the eight gods and one goddess's proxy, and Corwin at the foot of the table. Odin removed a file from his cloak and spread it on the table before him. "Corwin Ravenhair," he said, turning his one remaining eye on the uniformed young man. "Son of Skuld Ravenhair, Norn and Valkyrie, and of Benjamin Hutchins of Earth, the Midgard Knight, Slayer of Fenris. 1 year and 2 months ago, you placed before this council your petition to be considered for full membership in the Pantheon of the Aesir, your trial of ascension to be administered when this council judged that you were of sufficient age and training to undertake such a task. Do you still wish this thing to be done? Speak." Corwin hoped that his voice wouldn't crack and betray him as he replied, "All Father, I do." Odin nodded gravely. "So be it then," he said. "This council has deliberated, and the place and manner of your trial have been decided. Are you prepared to receive your instructions?" Corwin nodded. "All Father, I am." "A moment, All Father, if I may," said Frey. Odin glanced at the blonde god, commander of the Golden City's home defense forces, with a mildly curious expression. "Speak," he said. "Why do you wish to be tested and ascend, Corwin Ravenhair?" asked Frey. "I know this question was asked and answered when you made your petition, but bear with me. A man's motivations may change greatly in more than a year." Corwin mastered his surprise at the unexpected question, not showing it on his face. He hesitated only briefly before replying, "A fair question, General Lightwalker. In essence, you're asking me, why do you seek power? Yes?" Frey nodded, smiling faintly. "Yes." Erd looked faintly annoyed, but Corwin only nodded and replied, "What does it really matter, General? I could smile at you and say, because it is my birthright, as the marks on my face make plain, and I will have it. Or I could tell you a long and rambling story about a time when I was a small boy and, hearing of the brave exploits of my ancestors, decided that my life's wish was to emulate them." Corwin paused, a private little smile playing at his lips, despite the august nature of his interrogator, and continued, "Or I could tell you the truth, that I want to be the kind of man who helps the people he loves with all his strength, and in order to be able to do as much for them as possible, I intend to gather to myself as much strength as I can." Erd grinned and touched her nephew's booted foot under the table. "Good answer," her laughing eyes seemed to say. Frey regarded him for a moment, frowning. "Noble intentions," said he at last. "But good intentions are..." "Frey," said Odin, a little sharply, "the council's deliberations are over. Your reservations have been noted. What do you intend with this line of inquiry? To dissuade him from pursuing his trial? Frey glanced at the Allfather, then nodded, not answering the rhetorical question, but acknowledging the rebuke. I am sorry, Allfather, he said. It is merely that I feel so strongly about the risks involved. You are right, the time for objecting is past. I withdraw. Corwin glanced from one god to the other, puzzlement slipping faintly out from under his official occasion mask. Now what the hell was that all about? Sure, he'd never been particularly pally with Frey, but he'd never had any indication that the guy didn't want him ascending before. And Freya's clear eyes were worried, locked on her brother's face. Clearly she had the same reservations, whatever they were. Odin got to his feet and moved aside. Very well. The time has come, Corwin Ravenhair, for you to learn what task awaits you. As you are a Valkyrie, your deputy commander will conduct the briefing. Colonel Silverspear, if you please. Brunhilde got up, straightened her uniform, and went to the head of the table, nodding acknowledgement to the Allfather as she stood where he had just been sitting. Creation is made up of the 9 worlds of legend, she said in a businesslike tone. First there are the high celestial worlds, Asgard, where we Æsir dwell, Vanaheim, home of our cousins, the Vanir, and Alfheim, land of the elves, the dwarves, and the great dragons. Below us are the lesser celestial worlds of Jotunheim, land of giants, and Svartalfheim, where dwell the Svartelves and Underdwarves. Then comes Midgard, the middle world, the realm of mortal men. And below all are the nether worlds, Hel of the dead, Niflheim of the dishonored, and Muspelheim of the damned and forgotten, the den of dread Surtur and his foul minions. All these worlds are maintained in their existence by the world engine, which toils endlessly in this very castle. All this is known, and has been known, since the Allfather and his brothers wrought it all from the bones of great dead Ymir, uncounted eons ago. All this has been accepted as the unblemished and immovable truth since time immemorial. But as a model of all that is known to be, it is incomplete. Corwin blinked. Was this headed where he thought it was headed? Over 1,000 standard years ago, Brunhilde went on, a routine debugging of the celestial system revealed certain anomalies in the structure of space-time which could not be initially explained. Investigations were made by the Department of Celestial Cartography, who discovered that there is, in fact, a 10th plane, existing in the dimensional interstice between Svartalfheim, the lowest of the celestial realms, and the corporeal plane of Midgard. Little is known of the origins of this plane. It appears to have spontaneously appeared, through some ill-understood interaction between the sorcerous reality of the celestial worlds and the laws of Midgard's nature. What is known is this. It is not part of creation. What? Blurted Nall. This part of the briefing, Corwin knew, was mainly for his benefit. Brunhilde was aware that Corwin already knew this much, though most of the council didn't know that. His aunt Vertandi was not technically supposed to have told her nephew about the 10th world, but Vertandi Wishbringer Morisato kept her own counsel on such matters. The 10th world, the Valkyrie repeated for the little dragon, is not part of creation. It was not wrought by Odin, Vili, and Ve out of the bones of Ymir. It does not enjoy the world engine's protection. It has its own existence. It is literally a separate realm, albeit a small one, complete unto itself in the gap between the high and middle worlds. What I've just told you is not common knowledge, she added. Among the general populace of Asgard and Vanaheim, and I'm sure Alfheim as well, the 10th world is believed to be a myth, a popular legend like the Midgardian story of lost Atlantis. But it's real. All too real. Then why the myth? Why isn't it taught to children with the nine worlds? Asked Nall. Because, said Frey Lightwalker, it is the key to Armageddon. You overstate the danger, Frey, Thor grumbled. You're too damn cautious. That's always been your problem. Urd thought that always was a little rich, given that Frey's recklessness had been all but legendary before a certain incident had taught him the value of caution the hard way. But she held her peace. The Allfather was already interjecting. Enough, Odin said. Colonel Silverspear, explain it, please. Brunhilde nodded. When the Tenth World was first discovered, a goodwill expedition was dispatched from Asgard, under the command of Balder Goldenlight, to make contact with this world, gauge its level of sophistication, and secure a peaceful alliance with its people, if possible. What resulted was nearly the end of the world. Corwin suppressed a wholly inappropriate giggle, successfully enough that only Nall, who nearly bit his ear in exasperation, knew he'd had to. What no one understood, until it was nearly too late, Brunhilde said, was what the Tenth World's unique nature meant to Asgard's most important prophecy. The Tenth World was not part of creation. Nothing in it had sworn the Balder Oath. Corwin couldn't quite prevent himself from gaping. The surprise was all the worse for him because, despite the prohibition, he knew of the Tenth World already. He had always wondered why the subject was veiled in such mystery. Now he knew. If regular communication, let alone trade, between the Nine Worlds and the Tenth existed, then it would be impossible to guarantee the Shining One's safety. Tools, equipment, even outright weapons from the Tenth World would flow into the Nine, and any one of them could be raised against Balder, with all the ghastly consequences that carried with it at the time. Nowadays, of course, it was probably not an issue. Balder had died. The Ragnarok had come. And Skuld Ravenhair, Corwin's mother, had fouled up the prophecy by involving his father and a number of other mortal heroes in the final battle. In the end, the forces of evil had been thrown back, creation saved from its prophesied end in fire. Now opinion was divided as to what Baldur's significance was. Some, Skuld among them, believed that the prophecy was void, overturned by the intervention of the Midgard Knight and his friends, and that Baldur's death now, though tragic, would trigger nothing, herald nothing, but the mourning of his friends. Others, like Frey, believed that, Surtur having failed to destroy the Nine Worlds in fire, the clash was not the true Ragnarok, and that Baldur's death was still the linchpin of Armageddon. Baldur himself was rather bemused by the controversy, and remarked that he would just as soon not find out either way. Corwin forced himself to concentrate on what Brunhilde was saying. There was a misunderstanding with the Tenth World's High Priestess. You will hear more of the position, along with what little else we know of the world, anon. And Balder was gravely wounded, nearly killed. The rest of the expedition was terror-stricken. If Balder had died, the Ragnarok would have begun, and all creation would have been destroyed. They conveyed him home forthwith, their investigation into the Tenth World barely begun. Tell him the rest, Brunhilde. He has a right to know, said Frey. I commanded that expedition, with my Lord Balder incapacitated. I would hardly describe myself as terror-stricken, he added a bit archly, but I was gravely concerned. I still am. I won't mince words or apologize for it. When I returned home, I implored the Aesir Council, of which I was not then a member, to make war on the Tenth World and destroy it, because of the terrible menace it poses to all creation. But my words were not heeded. Indeed not, Brunhilde replied coolly. But under General Lightwalker's prodding, and that of his sister and other followers, the Council did decide that the Tenth World should be sealed, all access to and knowledge of it forbidden to all but the highest of officials. Perhaps a dozen people in Asgard know that it exists at all, and that's a few more than should, she added with what looked paradoxically like a faint smile. Only four, the three members of the original expedition still living, and the Norn Vertandi, know how to reach it. We believe that there has been some leakage of information to the Dragons of Alfheim, Frey said with a pointed look at Nall, and to the Svartelves in particular. However, neither group is believed to be so foolish that they would do anything with the knowledge, and they have just as much of a vested interest in keeping word of it from reaching the pit. So, despite my objections, the matter hasn't been given much priority. Enough, said Brunhilde. We must move on to what we know of the Tenth World itself. For that I will turn the floor over to one who has been there. She went to the door leading to Odin's office, opened it, and said, Lord Balder? Balder Goldenlight held the position of sun god for a good reason. He brightened everywhere he went, not just with his brilliant good looks, but also his winning personality. He had a kind word for everyone, perpetually sunny. Having died once and returned to life hadn't done anything to hamper his optimistic attitude. Now he smiled benevolently at Corwin and said, So you're the one, eh? Soon we'll be calling you the Cavalier of Three Worlds. But I suppose I'm getting ahead of the game, he added. At any rate, they want me to tell you what I learned of Sephiro before I managed to get myself stabbed and Frey called the whole thing off. Corwin's heart jumped in his chest. So he'd been right. The mysterious, legendary Tenth World was Sephiro. With his unauthorized knowledge of the Tenth World, he'd been almost certain of it since the first time Utrinna Tenjo told him about her homeworld in detail, about the mystic forces there and the peculiar convergence in familiar things. The way parts of Sephiro, filtered through Utrinna's memory, reminded Corwin of Asgard, while others were eerie parallels of Midgard. To have his theory vindicated now, before his trial rather than after, in a manner with these implications. He fought to keep his fists from clenching and sit still as Balder spoke. Sephiro is a mystic realm, similar in many ways to Alfheim, Balder said, his tone becoming a bit didactic, as he put his hands behind his back and paced slightly at the head of the table. The old sorceries work there, as they do in any of the nine worlds. If anything, they seem to be more powerful than in, say, Midgard. When I was there was a thriving wizardly tradition, which seemed to be based on mixed echoes of the elven, shamanic, Ys, Van, and mortal hermetic traditions. The Sephirian magisphere is extremely volatile, Frey put in. He might not like whatever plan was afoot, but he felt bound by his oath as a counselor to offer whatever help he could, and so his objections having been overruled, he did so. I was a young warrior mage at the time, and I found myself considerably more powerful than I had been at home. I didn't have time for many experiments, but it seemed to me that a person's will was the defining factor for almost everything in Sephiro. Common people could become mages if they only wanted it badly enough. We met a few in our travels before we reached the Temple City. You're getting ahead of things again, Frey, Balder chided the younger god gently. But you make a valid point. Magic in Sephiro is recognizable, but manifestly different, and the differences are plain to feel in execution. At any rate, there are no gods in Sephiro, or perhaps everyone is a god. The leveling factor of the will-influenced, mutable magisphere makes for quite a different situation than we have here. Our first order of business when we arrived was to determine how the Tenth World sustains itself, if it's outside the world engine's sphere of influence. This turned out to be relatively easy, Balder noted with a chuckle. Even the common people knew. In fact, at first we thought what they were telling us couldn't be right, had to be some kind of popular myth, just because it was so well known. It turns out that the power and responsibility for the maintenance of Sephiroth's unique pocket of existence vests in a single mortal resident, the person with the strongest, most determined will. That person is called the Pillar of Sephiroth. He, or she, I suppose, but it was he when we were there, a man by the name of Vegan, spends his every waking moment praying for the security and safety of the world, like a living world engine. Corwin blinked. "Like Aunt Belle did," he murmured. "Exactly," said Balder, nodding. "Just like your Aunt Vertandi did after Loki destroyed the world engine. In Sephiroth's case, the world is so much smaller, and the Magisphere so much more mutable, that a single mortal's will can sustain it without danger to that mortal's life. But that's all he can do with himself. It's quite a lonely existence." "I can imagine," said Corwin quietly. "There are, or were, 1,000 years ago, two other persons of supreme importance in Sephiroth," Balder went on. "The first is the Prince, who seems to serve as a sort of roving error corrector. The Prince's role is to rescue people in danger, help people in need, that sort of thing. The Pillar's prayers make for a very tranquil world in which little rescuing is needed, but some things slip through the cracks, and for those, the Prince is there. The one we had met was named Ultima. Terribly nervous fellow. But then, we had just invaded his world from beyond the crystal spheres. Anyway, the Prince. Not much more to tell about that. Third is the High Priestess, whose main function is as a protector for the Pillar. And not a ceremonial one, as I found out to my chagrin," he added, chuckling. "When we were there, her name was Sabra, and she didn't appreciate people trying to get in to see the Pillar without an appointment." "It's all well to joke," Frey said. "She nearly ended everything." "Well, she had no way of knowing that, Frey," Balder pointed out mildly. "She thought I was attacking her sacred trust, so she skewered me. I'd have done the same in her position." "At any rate," he said, returning his eyes to Corwin, "these three people make up Sephiroth's Trinity. They embody the will, the heart, and the strength of the 10th world. I wish I could tell you more about them, whether the positions are inherited or passed on through some sort of ritual or eternal or what have you. But we weren't there long enough, thanks to my unfortunate tangle with Sabra, and no one has been back since." "The world does or did have some other titled functionaries," Frey added. "There was a master mage, who was apparently responsible for the selection and training of the 10th world's top sorcerers, and a master smith, who maintained and passed down the local traditions of mystic weapons crafting. There may have been other masters for other trades, but we didn't see any." "It's not much to go on," said Balder, "but I'm afraid it's all we have. Good luck to you tomorrow, son. I pray I'll be feasting your ascension soon." With a bow and a last kind smile, he showed himself back out, leaving Brunhilde to take over again. "Recently, the Celestial Monitoring Bureau has been noting increased disturbances in the energy emissions of the 10th world," said the Valkyrie. "They believe, based on Baldur's report as to the world's magisphere, and the centuries of observational data they have collected, that the readings indicate a serious crisis within Sephiroth, one which threatens to topple its balance and possibly destroy it altogether. This has been going on for some time, it's hard to say how long. At least, they think, 150 years. But until recently it was put down to natural chaos factors. Recently, though, within the last 2 years, it has become much more violent. The CMB's predictions wing now believe that the 10th world is rapidly nearing collapse, possibly within the next month. That's why your trial has been moved up. We were planning to send you in May, but by then it might be too late." Odin stepped back to the head of the table, nodding. "Your trial, Corwin Ravenhair," he said, "is to go to the 10th world, determine the cause of its crisis, and, if possible, gauge the impact it will have on the 9 worlds if it continues unchecked. We don't expect you to stop it. We don't expect you'll be able to stop it. We just want to know what's going on, and whether it poses any immediate danger to creation. Are you prepared to undertake this task?" Corwin got to his feet, forcing himself not to jump to them, nodded, and said firmly, "Allfather, I am." "Then prepare your equipment, and good luck to you," said Odin. "Colonel Silverspear will take charge of your preparations." Nekomikoka Tomodachi. Utena Tenjo had to hand it to Skuld Ravenhair. She didn't present the appearance of a woman whose only son was far, far away, beginning an ordeal which, by design, would either leave him greater than he was, or, well, dead. She didn't look anywhere near as nervous as, say, Utena herself, and Corwin was Skuld's son, her only child. And it certainly wasn't because she didn't care whether he lived or died. Utena knew well the strong bond between mother and son. There were times when it made her a little envious, since she barely remembered her own parents. They'd died when she was very small. Only a little, though, and never for very long. She suspected mainly because Corwin and his mother didn't often have a traditional mother-son dynamic. Perhaps because Skuld was so close in apparent age to her son, and getting closer all the time, as he grew up and she remained agelessly 17-ish. She was usually more like his pal than his mother. Over the summer, when she'd lived with them, Utena had had plenty of opportunity to observe the Ravenhairs in their natural habitat, and it had been an illuminating and amusing experience. She'd also become fairly close to Skuld herself, which was another thing that muted her envy. It is, after all, difficult to envy that which one has oneself. Skuld finished pouring milk on her cereal. A grown woman, a goddess no less, eating Lucky Charms for dessert after supper. It made Utena, who reminded herself primly that she was, after all, only a girl of 16, feel justified taking them too. Then grinned across the table at her. "I've got to hand it to you," said Skuld. "You don't look anywhere near as tense as I feel." Utrinal laughed. "I was just thinking the same thing about you. On the inside, I'm a wreck. I don't know how I'm going to make it through the next... however long this takes," she added with a nervous chuckle. Skuld smiled, reached across the little table in her compact house's kitchen cum dining room, and patted Utrinal's arm. "You'll make it, same as me. That's why we're here together, right? To keep each other sane. We've done a pretty good job so far today." Utena grinned. "Yeah, I guess we have. What's on the agenda for tonight?" "Well," said Skuld, becoming serious, "I thought maybe we'd look into the disappearance of Corwin's schoolmate." Utena blinked. "The New Avalon cops are already..." "Yes, I know," said Skuld, "but there's something about this situation that bothers me." She tapped her chin thoughtfully. "Three girls don't just disappear from the observation deck at the entire state building, not without some trace of their having gone. You can't beam somebody into or out of the building, the security system sees to that, and the physical security is quite good. One girl I could see possibly being snatched without anyone noticing in the crowds, but three? All at the same time, one of them a Kumbari Seleucian? No, I don't think so." "You think it was, what, something sorcerous?" Skuld nodded. "I'd bet on it. And after we're through here, if you're game, we'll go and find out." "Well, sure, but how are we going to get in? The top O-deck is still sealed for investigation, and I don't know if that NAPD sergeant who took over from Hammer would appreciate us tromping around his crime scene." "That was a stroke of bad luck, Marty getting reassigned," said Skuld, nodding. "Big Fire would pick this week to start making trouble on the docks. If he hadn't been pulled to work that case, we could just ask him and go on in. As it is..." Skuld finished her cereal, drank the milk, then used her napkin and stood up decisively. We'll have to use the fountain. I'll be nice, said Noll, and not say I told you so. Good, Corwin grumbled. He finished tying his left boot, stepped down from the bench, and went to examine himself in the mirror. He didn't look particularly threatening, or even all that impressive, which was more or less the point. A medium-height young man with a light fighter's build, broad shoulders, narrow waist, limbs well-balanced and finely muscled, his big, powerful hands still slightly disproportionate, he was dressed in sturdy, plain traveling clothes, blue jeans, matching denim shirt, and heavy hiking boots. He wore his Valkyrie sidearm, a gleaming black 30-caliber Mauser broom-handle pistol, in a shoulder holster, and had a nondescript gray tunic to pull over it. His facial markings had passed muster. Facial tattoos were not uncommon in some parts of Sephiro, according to Baldur's report and Utrina's own descriptions. Some people might think him a mage, but that would only be to the good. Sorcerers were respected in the 10th world, not hated and usually not feared. The only pieces of jewelry he wore were a chunky Midgard-rated wristwatch. Utrina's descriptions indicated that Sephiro's time and Midgard's were the same, and his silver Institute Duelist's rose seal. Corwin surveyed himself, then pulled the tunic on over his shirt. It was full enough to hide his weapon, but the V-neck was deep enough that he could draw the Mauser without difficulty or delay. He practiced the maneuver a couple of times just to make sure. Then he pulled a multi-paneled Mycian hunter's cloak, the garment of 1,000 uses, over his head, topped himself with a brown leather outback hat, and examined himself again with a thoughtful, something's-missing look. Then he smiled, folded back one of the cloak's front panels, and pinned the silver rose Utrina had given him for their first Christmas to the inside of his tunic, where it wouldn't show, but would be near his heart. Okay, he said, shaking down his cloak and picking up the battered brown leather satchel which sat on the bench next to the nearest row of lockers. Let's get this show on the road. Noll, divested of his finery and looking more or less like an ordinary cat again, jumped from the shelf of Corwin's Valkyrie locker to his shoulder. The young man slammed the locker shut, then turned to take his leave, and jumped back in surprise to see Vigdis Brightblade standing there beaming at him. "Shh," she whispered, finger to her lips. "I know I'm not supposed to be in here, but I had to wish you good luck. Hilti told me where they're sending you." Corwin still hadn't quite gotten used to the gorgeous redhead the formerly annoying, formerly little Valkyrie had turned herself into since the holidays, when, before yesterday, he'd last seen her. He blinked at her, didn't even think of remonstrating with her for breaking his petitioner's isolation, and said, thanks. Vigdis grinned at his discomfiture. She'd been enjoying the effect her new form had on him ever since she'd reintroduced herself the day before. She draped her arms around his neck, Noll moving obligingly out of the way, put her forehead to his and murmured playfully, "Before you go, are you sure you don't want to be my boyfriend?" Corwin blinked, searching his mind for an appropriate response, and finally said softly, "Ask me again later." Vigdis grinned and gave him a quick, playful kiss. "I might do that," she said. Then she took a step back, reached into the bodice of her duty uniform, and said, "Which reminds me, I have something in here for you." A moment later, she pulled out a small object on a cord, ducked out of the cord's loop, pulled it gently free of her cascade of fiery curls, and handed it to him. He held it, still warm from her body, in his hand and looked at it. It was a small plaque of silvery metal, cut into a rough rectangle about an inch long, with a single character embossed on it. A diamond shape, wider than tall, bisected by a vertical line. Corwin knew the symbol well, of course. It was a Norse rune, Yera, the symbol of a successful endeavor or the rewards of hard work. He looked from the amulet to the smiling Valkyrie and back, then slipped the black cord over his head and let the rune fall into his shirt, against his own chest. Several different interpretations for the rune rattled through his head, all of them good, all of them heartening indications of just how well recovered Vigdis was from the raging jealousy that had characterized her before the draft of years had changed her. "Thank you," he said softly. Vigdis nodded. "Success to you, Lord Corwin," she told him, prematurely, since he was yet unascended, and she bowed to show that she really meant it. Then she straightened and added quietly, "In all things." Corwin would have stayed to try and make it plain how many thanks he felt that gesture was owed, but there was no time, and she understood that better, perhaps, than he. With a hand on his shoulder and a kiss on his cheek, she ushered him out of the Valkyrie locker room and into the corridor that led to the hall. The Valkyrie's hall was fully repaired from the trauma it had suffered in Vigdis's battle with Utnatenjo some weeks before. Only a faintly noticeable patch of slightly darker stone betrayed the place where a large crater in the floor had been repaired. No other damage was visually apparent. Someone was waiting for him there, next to an ancient, ornate, silver-framed, full-length, freestanding mirror, and Corwin smiled to see her. Of course it would be her, he thought, feeling her serenity wash away even the nervousness that roiled within him. Nall relaxed palpably on his shoulder, soothed by the same quieting presence. Beldandi didn't say a word. She merely stepped up to him, her full-dress Norn's court robes rustling softly, and touched his face with both hands, running her fingers down from his brow to his cheeks as if blind and trying to read his face. Then she smiled ever so slightly and touched Nall on the end of his nose, before turning to the mirror and placing her palm against its cool, smooth surface. At her touch the glass rippled and sang like water, its surface shimmering with coruscant light, that matched the light shining from her needle-thin forehead brand. After a moment it stabilized, glowing softly and very gently undulating, and she turned again to Corwin. Still silent, she smiled her most calming smile, the one that spoke of her utter conviction that the person at whom she smiled would prevail in whatever endeavor. Then she leaned forward and very softly kissed her nephew, widening his eyes in surprise. The Norn slipped artfully around him, propelling him to and through the mirror so subtly and gently that he didn't have the sensation of being guided at all. When the glow collapsed, Beldandi stood alone in the Valkyrie's hall. She remained there for a long time, silently regarding the mirror. Then, with a wave of her hand, she banished it to whence it came and left the soundless vastness of the hall.